Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook Profiles. I'm Paula Schiller. The first running of the Kuskokwim 300 sled dog race is over, but dog mushing fever continues through the major city races, to the Iditarod, and in all the villages in between. The town of Bethel worked hard for its first big race, and it paid off in a roster full of the state's top cross-country racers. The biggest excitement, of course, was at the finish line. And thanks to Corey Flintoff of KYUK in Bethel, here's a replay of what it was like as Rick Swenson came in the winner.
There's an enormous amount of excitement in seeing this great racer, two-time Iditarod champion, and a magnificent team coming up to the finish line. He's moving. He's pedaling now. He's getting them to move a little bit faster. He's coming in. He's going to make a good finish. You can probably hear in the background a little bit of the excitement. Some of the handlers are moving up now. We're standing here in the chute with some of the race officials and the handlers getting ready. Now here they come in, and they are a beautiful team, just magnificent, moving along at a real good clip. And here's Swenson whistling to his dogs. He's pedaling as he comes in, really kicking. They're slowing down a little bit. They can sort of see that crush of people, but of course, they've been through some magnificent finishes before. The dogs look like they're in good shape. I see boots on at least one dog. It looks like he might have had some foot problems. And here they come, right up to the finish line, moving in. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven dogs, eight, nine, a total of nine dogs all together, right across the line. Rick Swenson, the winner of the first annual Kuskokwim 300 race. And here he is, moving in. Dogs look good. He looks good. He's hugging his wife, Kathy, giving her a big kiss here at the finish line. He's up now. He's petting the dogs, giving them a little encouragement. He's moving up now to his lead dog, kneeling down in the snow, petting that lead dog. Here's Norman Cohen. Total time for Rick Swenson. Am I reading this right, Norman? 2 days, 23 hours, 21 minutes, and 35 seconds. Can I just see that again? Once again, that's 2 days, 23 hours, 21 minutes, and 35 seconds for Rick Swenson, winner of the Kuskokwim 300.
Hey, it sounds to me like a record.
Absolutely, the first record holder for the Kuskokwim 300.
Well, I doubt it'll stand very long. All you need is some decent weather, and you can do better than this. But I figured it'd take 50 hours, so we beat it, what I had figured it would take. But now that I know what it's like, if you had decent weather, you could do this pretty fast.
Does that mean that you'd consider running it again?
If you guys could guarantee the weather. No, I think that the tough weather is, that's part of it. Long distance racing isn't in downtown Anchorage and stay in a motel. It's you got to be a little bit tougher.
I understand that instead of staying in a motel, at one point you and Jerry Austin had to stay in George One's fish camp downriver from Antioch. How long were you stuck there?
Oh, we weren't there more than maybe an hour and a half. It was just a matter of we could have stayed out in the weather, but my pockets and even the pockets on the inside on my shirt were full of snow. You know, underneath two layers of clothes. I mean, it was just, I took some pictures out there in it, so I've got proof, if they turn out.
We do have another team coming in here, and we're going to have to ask people to make some room.
And while we're waiting for the next team to come in, we'll hear another musher, Myron Engsman of Bethel, describe those whiteout conditions that caught him between Kalskag and Antioch.
Before it got to the real severe point where you didn't know if you could proceed, we were approximately halfway between the villages, and it would have been almost as hard going back as it was going forward in terms of finding the trail. Of course, the wind would have been at our back for traveling, but The trail was virtually obliterated both ways, so things were going pretty bad. The wind was virtually stopping the dogs at times. It was obliterating the trail, making it hard to see the team. I couldn't wear my glasses, and I was freezing up my eyes kind of regularly. Three or four times I had a snow blow over my eyes and freeze them shut, and I couldn't really use them anyway, so it didn't really bother me that they were frozen shut because I wasn't watching where I was going. And there was a very lightly marked trail at that point, so there was no real certain way of telling if the dogs were proceeding the right direction. Fortunately, the dogs did stay on the trail and eventually came to Antioch, but there is a point in the middle of that trail where it was not wise to stop, not wise to turn around, and not wise to go ahead. So it was a serious concern.
Back at the finish line now with Corey Flintoff and the second team to come in.
We've got another team at least coming in, and judging from the reports that we had earlier, it may be two teams, because Susan Butcher and Joe Reddington Sr. were very close together in the early parts of, well, throughout the race, actually. They've come into all the checkpoints from Antioch on within just a matter of a minute or two of one another. And it's not really clear whether there's clearly a partnership going on there, but it's not clear whether or not it'll develop into a rivalry when they get around to the very last part of the race here.
We've got a team coming in here.
Yes, and by golly, it's a sled with a white cover.
Yeah, it's Susan Butcher.
Susan Butcher, and she's well ahead. We don't see another team in the background at the moment. There's a lot of excitement. You can hear the whistling and clapping now. Rick Swenson, Rick and Kathy Swenson waiting here at the finish line for Susan Butcher to cross. Coming in second. Dogs moving along at a good clip. She's really coming in nicely. I can see some dogs, though, in the team that are booted, some possible foot problems there. She's moving in nice and smoothly, though. You can hear the applause and the cheering for those dogs. They look good. They seem to be in good shape. They don't look tired at all. They look nice and healthy. Coming in right across the finish line, Susan Butcher, coming in second in the Kuskokwim 300 race. Well-wishers are crowding around. Here's Norman Cohen with her time. 2 days, Norman, 23 hours, 34 minutes, and 27 seconds. Here she is, Susan Butcher. Looking good, accepting congratulations from people here, spectators that have come into the shoot. How do you feel about the Kuskokwim 300? You think you'd run it again if it's held next year?
Yeah, I think so, especially if the trail was better marked. Other than that, it was pretty good. And I don't assume you'd always have this bad of weather.
Of all the publicity the weather has received statewide in this race, most everyone that lives here would explain that the weather we had was extraordinary weather for any time, for any winter here in Bethel. We normally don't see it 50 below here, and we normally don't see snowstorms with 100 below wind chill factors and driving snow of the type we had on this race. And certainly we wouldn't expect to see one of those kind of days followed by the other of those kind of days. Our normal winter here is 0 to 20 below, and winds 10, 20 miles an hour, sometimes 30 miles an hour, but hardly anything like we had on the race. It's an unusual combination of weather factors that made our race so newsworthy statewide this year, and I would be surprised if we saw anything like that again in the next race or two.
We have another team coming, and we assume that it's going to be Joe Reddington Sr. Here he comes. Joe Reddington, he looks good. He's kicking vigorously. The father of the Iditarod, 62-year-old musher with 31 years experience. Here they come. Here they come right down the chute, moving along really nicely. A beautiful looking team. He has almost matched leaders in front. He's coming across. He stops in there. He's across the finish line, and now the spectators move in with their congratulations. You can hear people applauding. people that want to just come up and see the man who's done so much for long distance dog mushing in the state of Alaska and all throughout the United States. Like the mushers who came in before him, he's moving up to look over his dog team. Going up now to have a look at his leaders. He's patting them and being congratulated. Here's Norman Cohen with the time for Joe Reddington.
3 days.
3 days, 3 minutes, and 7 seconds. 3 days, 3 minutes, and 7 seconds, the total time for Joe Reddington. It made him third in the Kuskokwim 300. How you feeling, Joe?
Hello there.
How you feeling?
All good. Very good.
Great. Do you have any problems with the weather or with the trail?
I think everybody had some problems with the weather this time. But it was a great race. And I'll be back for another one.
Be back for another one. That's great to hear. Would you change your strategy in this next race at all?
Well, I'm not sure. I just give it heck all the way. That's about all you can do, I think.
And that seemed to be the philosophy of all the Kuskokwim 300 mushers. And in that kind of weather, it had to be the best policy.
Do you think that any musher or team was ever in real serious physical danger during the race?
Well, unfortunately, yes. We did have a situation that I believe was very dangerous. I wasn't part of it, but from what I have heard about it, it was dangerous under the circumstances. We had one musher, relatively new to mushing, who had a team that's relatively untested, that got off the trail and onto a kind of a side trail and eventually sat down on the trail and would not proceed either front or back, and it was roughly 50 below zero when that happened. The musher crawled into a sleeping bag and sat there with a dog to keep warm, hoping that someone would find the team. The next day then, the weather changed to whiteout conditions with 100 below wind chill, and this musher was still in the sleeping bag without any hope of moving any direction with these dogs, and was fortunately found about 3 o'clock the next afternoon, I believe, after waiting approximately 12 hours. That was a serious situation, one that can happen in bad weather in a race like this, and one that fortunately didn't result in any serious injury other than a little minor frostbite.
So with no real casualties, the first running of the Kuskokwim 300 was a success, and the top 5 finishers are Iditarod veterans. But with so many professionals in the running, Corey Flintoff asked Myron Anksman if the local mushers felt that the big-timers were stealing the thunder and the $10,000 in prize money from the community.
No, I didn't notice much of that at all. First of all, the prize money was intended to attract outside mushers because local people just never had a chance to see outside mushers here racing locally and compete against outside mushers. A lot of the local people thought they might do a little bit better in comparison to the experienced cross-country mushers that took part in the race, and when they didn't tell me that they felt slighted in any way, but instead indicated they'd learned a lot and were glad for the experience, the ability to see these kind of professionals take part so that next year they, the locals, could do a bit better and take home a bigger chunk of the prize money.
Perhaps the real winner of the Kuskokwim 300 is the city of Bethel.
The community seemed to really be tickled at the excitement that was raised in the community during the race, before and after the race, and also tickled by the statewide attention that the race brought to our area, something that we don't often get, especially positive statewide attention, is sadly lacking in Bethel. Most of the statewide attention is on aspects of the community in the area that are negative, and this is a pleasant change.
Myron Anksman of the Kuskokwim 300 Race Committee talking to Corey Flintoff of KYUK in Bethel. Thank you, Corey. And if there's something happening in your town that we should know about, please tell us, and we'll do our best to share it with you on Chinook. I'm Paula Schiller, and this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaska Natives.
This is Chinook Patterns. I'm Paula Schiller with a special series about what happened in Barrow when the news media got a hold of a research report saying that 45% to 72% of the community is alcoholic.
It's common knowledge that the frequency of alcoholism in Alaska is extremely high compared to the other 49 states. And the recent publicity that we've been receiving in the news media tends to lead one to believe that the majority of the state's alcohol-related problems are centered here on the North Slope. They aren't.
Well, I think there's probably a problem that's, if not as large as the research report claims, almost as large. There's a bad problem. As far as the research report itself goes, I think on a professional basis, I have some questions that just need to be handled as a health professional dealing with a research report. As far as the town is concerned, I think the big excitement was the way the news was released. I think it would have been a matter of common courtesy to have come to the community first with a report and then allowed the report to be released through the community, not to have them wake up one morning at 9 o'clock and hear Paul Harvey calling them a bunch of drunks.
I didn't expect that it was that large. In fact, I even discussed with the borough attorney, with the mayor and his assistant, what some of the ramifications could be and what some of the negative things that could happen could be. I didn't know, I just thought they could be. And we discussed it, they agreed, they said, go ahead and do it. I went ahead and did it. It was bigger than everybody thought. And when I came back and got off the plane, I was fired instantly.
I'm very upset with this report. Although I don't doubt the fact that we have a problem, but I still think that these people that came in to do the research were working with someone like the former director of public safety, who had just one thing in his mind, creating sensationalism about the problem here. I sure am glad that he was dismissed from his position, because that's not a way to work positively in resolving a problem.
I was fired because I made a big issue out of it. I was fired as a scapegoat to absorb all the indignation and anger that people feel when they read about themselves in the newspapers and hear it on radio, such as they did. I was fired jumping the gun on a political issue that didn't exist until I did it. And it's not cool to have one of the lower people in any kind of government upstage the politicians. And that's precisely what happened.
That's what happened according to Kim Moeller. He used to be the North Slope Borough's Director of Public Safety, and he was the one who commissioned the research study in the first place. He was fired after he called a news conference on the subject in Anchorage.
The research report, standing alone, without anything positive attached to it or any inkling that we're doing anything about it, is a publicity disaster. There's no question about that. The effort that we made in Anchorage was to front end what was coming up from the lower 48 and not allow the research report to stand alone. So we wanted to get across the positive aspects of what the people in Barrow were doing about it. We wanted to make it a political issue in the state. We wanted to kick the state legislature in the shins and say, stand up and pay attention. If you don't, there's a whole lot of people going to die that you're going to be responsible for out of your own ignorance. There's no excuse for it. That state people, governor's office, has to take responsibility for it. They cannot simply assume, well, gee, you know, that's their problem, let them bear, let them take care of it. They don't want anybody to know about it anyway. And basically deny the kind of help from outside that they have to have. Nome, back during the flu epidemic, when people were dying and threatened the entire population of Nome, the rest of the state didn't sit around on their hands and say, well, gee, you have a problem, heal yourself, give yourself inoculations, take care of it yourself. You get massive aid from outside, and that's how you stop it. They don't get massive aid up here from outside. They haven't got a chance.
Why isn't Barrow listening to you, then?
I'm not sure they're not. The politicians certainly aren't, because they're in a highly reactive position right now. Firing me put a booster rocket on the whole issue, as far as the press is concerned. And now they're on the reactive, they're on the defensive. And now they're going to have to come out and give all kinds of reasons why they fired me. And they also have to come out in support of the program, even if they don't really support it. Because they're put on the spot. They can't undo what's already been done. They can't deny what's already been said. They can't relegate the research to some kind of slip in the calculator or some kind of slip in the computer. So they have to make some effort to support it. They have no choice.
We're not saying that we don't, we're not saying that we're not supporting it. Okay, we all don't like to hear poor results. Okay, but that's a fact of life. The report, indicates a fact of life. Okay, and what we have to do now is find some way of putting a stop to those statistics.
Part of what separated Kim Mueller from his job is the way he and the researchers define the problems and the way the borough officials see the situation. Ralph Anderson is special assistant to Mayor Hobson.
The Times reported that Mr. Mueller had said that all of the alcoholism here is a direct result of the taxation, the revenues raised from taxation of Prudhoe Bay development. And he said one of the ways to stop the problem was to stop development. We're against stopping development. We want development, especially in energy, to occur just as badly as everyone else does. Okay, except we'd like the development customized to the Arctic. Okay, rather than having a general development policy, we want to customize, to our needs.
But are you denying that the cash flow into a barrel is part of the problem with alcoholism? You can't really.
Well, I mean, I'm not denying that. Okay, it's not as direct as Kim had painted the picture to be. Okay, it's if anything, it's alcoholism here is an indirect result. Okay, it may be an indirect result, but it's not as direct as Kim had stated it was. Okay. Look at Fairbanks. I mean, during the pipeline construction, I mean, there was money flowing there. Taxes were, I mean, the borough and city were both taking in a bunch of taxes. and no one was going down there and telling them, hey, because of the taxes, you got a bunch of drunks on your hands, And that isn't the case up here either.
But the way the report reads, the way some people are talking, is that government development is part of the problem for not addressing the human concern.
Okay, well, how? Let me ask you a question. How do you stop government? How do you stop development? How do you stop that from occurring? Okay, when you're talking about a native people in Alaska that have lived a certain way for thousands and thousands of years, okay, how do you think they're going to accept any changes? Do you think changes will come easy?
No, I think that maybe they could come slower and give people a chance to adjust.
Okay, and I understand your point, but it's okay. It's slowing down development. Okay, but that's what we want. We want development customized to the Arctic. That's what I meant. Customized and government. Okay, working with development. Okay, not necessarily hand in hand with the oil industry. Okay, because the oil industry is sees oil and damn it, they want to get it. I mean, it's slowing down development. Sure, like Kim said. But not putting a total stop to it.
I think the people themselves will have to decide on whether to continue the amount of activity that's going on here, or whether we have to slow down. I think that the people, we ourselves can make our decision on whether we should slow down or not. And I just don't think it's right for anybody from the outside to come up and tell us what the heck to do. It's just like me going down south to Philadelphia and tell them that they have to, stop doing this and stop doing that, or do this and do that, and I just don't think it's right. The people themselves are going to decide which way we're going to go.
Patsy Amott was born and raised in Barrow, and while she firmly believes that it's up to the North Slope Inupiaq to decide the pace of development, she does admit that changes may have come too fast.
Well, on that part, I would have to say that, in my opinion, the development that has happened in our area has just been too rapid. Sure, there was some planning done on the part of the North Slope Borough and the Regional Corporation to make some changes within our standard of living and making improvements on, for example, the type of houses that we have, the sanitary conditions, the medical conditions, and that sort of thing. The intent was good, but I don't think the people that were involved in making all these changes did not really consider the how much of an impact it was going to have on the people. And, you know, I think that's one reason why there's been an increased consumption of alcohol. And it's just like any place else that's going through rapid change. A lot of problems are going to happen. But I am going to also say again that a lot of good things have happened because of our regional cooperation and also because of our borough. You know, we have home rule for the first time, and we can determine ourselves how things are going to go, how we're going to handle it. And the change has just been too rapid. I think it could have been at a slower pace, and I do hope that the other regions will take into consideration our experience in this area. Although I think there's been a lot of positive things that have happened because of these changes.
See, well, you know, here you go again, positive, negative. Yes, that influence has created most of the cultural disruption that we see. But had the borough and the regional corporation not been willing to take the lead, the development lead, to develop political authority, then the things that would have happened anyway, the people would have had no voice. The restriction of caribou, the problem with trying to restrict the whale, the leasing of the Beaufort Sea. For all the problems that this outside influence and development has brought in, this political muscle was necessary to preserve what we can. If you think of Inupiat leadership or Eskimo leadership in the world today across the Arctic, you don't think of the Nanaw Corporation. You don't think of anyone except the North Slope Borough usually. There were some sacrifices that had to be made, and we're suffering because of them. But had we not had this muscle, we couldn't have subsisted anyway. The subsistence existence would have gone with the whale and the caribou. At least we have a voice. At least we have a government that's saying, we know how you have to deal in the outside world, and we're going to make an attempt to deal with them and protect our people. It's a weight. You're sacrificing one good for another gain, but peoples all over the Arctic and Arctic Alaska are benefiting from the fact that Barrow has made this sacrifice and admitted the outside world to this degree.
After looking closely at the research report, Borough Health Director Elise Packatack found major defects which discount its worth to the community, and that the usable portions in it have been buried in the publicity uproar.
The paper does touch on some of the larger aspects of the problem, the influences from the outside. And had the paper been released or been brought to the attention of the community in a less sensationalist way, there's a good chance that we could have taken those valid parts of the study and dealt with them. I don't think you'll find anyone in this community that would deny that all changes stem back to the development of the profit corporation in the borough. Unfortunately, the manner in which the paper was released has created such high-riding feelings, and it's going to be a while before we're going to be able to look at it in a less than emotional way.
But that's what we'll try to do. Take a look at the research paper itself in the next edition of Chinook. I'm Paula Schiller, and this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.